Good morning. So last time we finished up talking about stacks, talking about some different ways of implementing them. The two big strategies were being based on a linked list or based on something like an array, like a vector. We also talked about queues, which we said were similar to stacks. We just had a different idea about where things started, which end of the list that was kept internally. And they had the same sort of options where we could have multiple implementations of a queue. Right, good. And we have this general concept of an abstract data type, which is somewhat similar to a class, but not tied to some particular language construct, where we have some data and a set of operations on it. And we have multiple things that could be happening inside to manage that data. For example, we had our example of lists, where we have this one interface, like the one you implemented for the list lab, which is something you could do with a linked list, or it's something you could do with a vector, it's something you could do with a bunch of other representations to provide the same operations, and depending on the implementation you'll choose, you get different trade-offs. And with an abstract data type, we provide one interface, and we let users easily switch between these depending on their actual needs. We also briefly talked about strings and IO. So then we started talking about our next topic, which was numbers. We talked about numbers in different bases, which is going to come up a lot because our computers, well, they don't work in base 10. We talked about specifying those numbers in C and converting between bases. And our general sort of simple method for converting to a base is to divide by the base, take the remainder, that's your last digit, then divide again, take the remainder, that's your next to last digit, and keep going until you get zero. So any questions about any of this? Any of these topics? Okay, so a note, I was asked last time about what is legal syntax as far as what's base 8 in C and what's not. So the rule is, in fact, that if you have a decimal point, it's base 10. Even if you have leading zeros, if you don't, it's base 8. If you try to do something like this, you get, that's a syntax error because you're asking for base 8 and 9 is not a digit in base 8. And so last time we looked at examples of converting between different bases. And it looked like what we had to do is we had to do a bunch of division. You can do that division in a different base. I'll talk a bit about that later. But generally this seems pretty tedious, especially for the task you might imagine you have to do of converting between two different bases that aren't base 10. You know, if you aren't comfortable doing all the division in some other base. So there's one particular special case which will come up a lot in this class and in the real world, which is converting from base 16, hexadecimal, to base 2. And 16 is a power of 2, it's 2 to the 4. And this means that each base 16 digit corresponds exactly to 4 binary digits, binary bits. And you can sort of prove this by doing a formula. If we have UZ, a two-digit base 16 number, then we write out what it means to be base 16, and we distribute our 2 to the 4, that's what 16 is, across the bits of U. So here I'm writing out U as 4 bits, because 4 bits holds the values from 0 to 15, that's the possible values of the base 16 digit. And I'm similarly writing out the digits of Z that way, not showing them all. So z third bit times 2 to the third, and so on. And so I have all these digits. This is just the expansion based on u3, u2, u1, u0 is the binary for what the digit u is, expanding that based on what base 2 means. And then I distribute my multiplication times 16, and I find out I'm multiplying the least significant digit of bit of u by 2 to the 4, the second least significant one by 2 to the 5, and so on. And that's the same as if I wrote out the bits of u followed by the bits of z, and that was my number, my binary number. So this means that when we have a hexadecimal number, we can just take each hexadecimal digit, convert it to binary, just put them together, and we get the right answer. And this holds in general whenever you're working with a power of 2 base, that you can take the digits, convert them to binary, put them together, you'll get the right answer. So for example, I have 1, 2, 3, 4 in base 16. If I want to convert this to binary, I can just say 1 is 0001 as 4 bits of binary, 2 is 0010 as 4 bits of binary, 3 is 0011 as 4 bits of binary, and so on. Just put those all together, that's the binary number. I don't need to divide this rather large thing by 2 13 times. And I can use this to go in the other direction. So if I have a binary number and I want to write it as base 16, I can just take groups of 4 starting at the end, 4 bits. And I can say, okay, I have 4 zeros, that's a 0 in base 16. I have 2 zeros and 2 ones, that's a 3 in base 16. I have 1110, that's D in base 16, and so on. And so this will come up all over the place because mostly we're going to use something like base 16 hexadecimal when we, want to think about bits, but we don't have room on our page to write 64 digits, which is a very common thing. So any questions about any of this base 16, base 2 conversion? Okay. So I'd like to give a brief note on bytes. So in this class, 1 byte is going to be 1 octet, that's 8 bits. That's where the name octet comes from. You might see some places. 2 nibbles, that's 2 hexadecimal digits, 8 bits. That's always what we mean in this class. There are, however, some very old machines where they called something else a byte. Because the name byte doesn't actually come from 8 bits, it comes from the minimum unit of memory you can access at once. But all systems you know of today refer to a byte as 8 bits, mostly because people decided to stop building machines with 36-bit integers a long time ago, which was a real thing. That's why you had a different, if you have 36-bit integers, it doesn't make sense to have 8-bit bytes. Okay. So since we know about base conversion, here's an exercise. That should be pretty quick. So I have 17 in base 9, give that to me in base 7. I'll give people 45 seconds to a minute. And you can talk, you can check with your neighbors, I don't need absolute silence. Would someone like to explain how they got an answer to this? Okay.
So to get 17 first, I said, okay, so 7 times 9 is 0, plus 1 times 9 is 1. So you got 9 plus 7 is 16, right? And then I said, okay, how many?
So you have 7 times 9 plus 7.
1 times 9.
Plus 7, yes.
Yeah.
So you did 1 times 9 plus 7, and you said, okay, that is 16.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So then there are 2 7s and 16, and then 2 left over, so 22. And
this equals 7 plus 7 plus 2. Yeah, so this is 2 and 2. 2 times 7 plus 2. Yeah, so that's probably the standard way of going about this. So here, converting to decimal was pretty natural with numbers that are this small, even though you don't have to do that, but it's probably more natural than like trying to do math in base 9. Example doing that. So any questions about what went on here? Do this. So, especially for lab next week, I'd hope that converting at least between small bases is pretty natural. Yes?
Why did you go to 16?
1 times 9 plus 7 is 16 in base 10. This is 16 base 10. So we have 1 times 9 because this is equal to 1 times 9 to the 1 plus 7 times 9 to the 0 by our definition of bases. And that she's just using that formula. Okay. Any other questions? And I guess I have, this is essentially how I did it. I just said 7 plus 9. Again, using that formula, 1 times 9 to the 1 plus 7 times 9 to the 0. Because we have the 1's place, the 9's place, 81's place, and so on. Okay. So a note in general. So I mentioned you can do math in other bases. So a lot of the time, people assume that the only way of solving some sort of problem that involves converting between bases, or even like doing math with numbers where we've given them to you in, say, base 16 or binary, is that, gosh, I'm going to have to convert that to decimal, do all my math in decimal, and convert back. And sometimes, and for many people, that might be the easiest way to do things. And I'm certainly not going to stop you from doing that if you think it's easier. But if you have something like this, and you need, like, here we have two base 16 numbers to multiply, yes, you could do this by hand by converting them both to decimal by hand, then multiplying in decimal, then converting the result back to base 16. That is a valid strategy that will get you the correct answer. But when you have something like this, it's probably easier to do the math in base 16. And this is what your computer is doing anyways. It's doing binary, but same sort of idea. And you can just do the same thing you would do for decimal math. You just have different possible digits. So for example, when I say 4 base 16 times 5 base 16 is 1 4 base 16, because 4 times 5 in base is 20 in base 10. And if you didn't, you know, figure that out intuitively, you can like do the conversion of 20 base 10 to base 16, which is probably less error prone than converting 1 2 3 4 4 base 16 to base 10. So this is just a strategy you can use. If you're more comfortable, just convert everything at the beginning to base 10, do all your math, convert it back, that's fine. But just like to note that all the math you learned with base 10 works with base 16 or binary, including multiplication and division and long division. Um, Also, I note that if you need to do calculations, like you can write little programs. Here I've done it in Python because I find that most convenient to code quickly compared to C, but like you should feel free to do that, like if you have access to a computer to do something where you need to do math with, you know, base 16 especially. Okay, so any questions about what I've done here? Okay, so our modern machines, as I alluded to, we represent integers and also real numbers using a series of bits. You might say, well, we're humans, we really like base 10. I'd really prefer not to do all this conversion. Why doesn't my computer just work in base 10? And, well, it's certainly possible to make machines which do that. In fact, many early computers did. So the ENIAC was one of the first big or general purpose machines, and it worked in base 10. The way it stored numbers is it had an array of 10 switches for each digit. So these were switches which were actually implemented with vacuum tubes. If you've seen a vacuum tube, something like this big, with a vacuum in it and some wires connected to it. But these were used to construct switches, which were either on or off. And the way they represented a base 10 number is you set one of these switches to on to represent the current value of the digit. And this design let you send a signal down one of these tracks and increment the number that was stored. And that's how this machine did math. That you could, because these were arranged in this loop, it was such that because this passed through a signal, when you sent a signal, you could go from having 6 be the one that switched to having 7. That was sort of the idea of the design. And we also had this output from 9, which was our carry bit. So we could go on to the next digit and apply the operation properly. This was the sort of design ENIAC used. So this meant that for each digit, we had tens of vacuum tubes. I've seen various numbers. I've seen 36 written down. I'm not sure if that's actually right, but tens of vacuum tubes. And this was in the 50s. The 40s. And each of these was around a cylinder, basically, that's around 1 1/4 inches in diameter and 2 3/4 inches high for each digit. So this is a very big machine. And you might say, well, if they're that big, you know, this seems kind of wasteful, right? For each digit, we have tens of switches because we're using base 10. And, you know, and we sort of have a fundamental reason why we want one switch for each possible value, because that's sort of how we make the machinery work, is that we want to send a signal and have that flip a switch. And in order to have that be natural, we're going to flip a switch to change what the digit is and have one switch for each digit. So from this, you know, we might say, well, the reason we're using base 2 is because if we're building machines out of switches, which is still what we're doing, we're not using these vacuum tubes anymore. We're using much more efficient, very, very, very tiny switches. But we're still essentially building machines out of switches, which are basically either off or on. We aren't building machines out of components which actually have 0 through 9. Or can do that. We're building machines out of components which have on or off. And so the most natural thing to do is have base 2 where we have our representation of numbers exactly correspond to these switches. And in fact, when the ENIAC was around, this idea was known. Some of the earlier machines used base 2. And apparently the reason the ENIAC didn't was actually not because of convenience, wasn't because they felt that you couldn't convert your calculations to base 2. It was because the designer was worried about stability of the hardware. Was worried that the sort of hardware people were using to do base 2 in those early days wasn't reliable enough. And they felt that they could build this circle of switches to be more reliable than that design. And that's no longer true. We now have pretty reliable ways of doing that. And there's some benefit to being able to input and output decimal numbers directly, but like that's not the main concern. So any questions about this? So if we're building machines in base 2 for efficiency, so what does addition look like? So here we see that we have addition where we move up to the next switch and possibly pass a value to the next digit worth of stuff. And in base 2, addition is a bit simpler. So our addition operation, we can say, well, if exactly 1 is set to 0, the result is 1 without the carry. So the bit current bit changes to the next to 1 if exactly 1 is set, otherwise it's 0. And if both are set to 1, the carry is 1. So this first thing here is something you might know from elsewhere as XOR. And this both are set to 1 is something you might know from elsewhere as AND. And these are both things which are easy to build in hardware to detect both of those scenarios. So we have sort of natural, simple designs for doing addition. And based on that, you can build pretty much all other math from pretty simple components that do a little bit of reasoning on switches. Okay. So, since we know we're using base 2, let's talk about how big base 2 numbers can be. So we're going to have a certain amount of switches for each number in our machine, a number of bits. So we're somehow going to choose that. And given that we have that number, we're going to have the value based on the formula we've seen for bases before. So I've just written out a summation, but it's the same thing I've written out sort of manually before. And the maximum possible value we can get is going to be, I sure did. It's going to be 2 to the n minus 1, which is not written in the exponent. So, and you can tell this from you can prove that by induction if you want to, but it's 2 to the n, the quantity, minus 1. I will correct this slide later. So, you have some missing pieces here. So this tells us our capacity. So based on the number of bits we choose, we have some maximum integer we can store. We don't have unlimited integers because, well, we would need to have unlimited physical space eventually. We'd eventually run out of room no matter how many gigabytes of memory we have. We can always think of a bigger number. And typically, we're going to choose some small number. So we have some things we need to decide. And there are some things we're going to talk about that are missing from this picture. So one is, how are we dealing with negative numbers? So what I have here, if you want a negative number, well, there's no possible value you could have for these bits, which will give you 1 with this formula. You always get positive numbers. Also, we're missing non-whole numbers. There's no possible value you can set for these bits where you get any number which isn't 1 times some whole number. And we also need to figure out what n is. So in C++, Our various types of integers have sizes. And the sizes aren't actually defined by the C++ language. So C++ decided we want the compiler to do what makes the most sense on each machine. So they just said, we're going to set some minimum sizes so people can write programs that work everywhere, but we're going to let the compiler decide, well, what size stuff does this machine have? Let me set the sizes appropriately. So the main, what I'm calling unsigned integer types, and unsigned means it can't be negative, so it has no plus or minus sign on it. You can think of that that way. Are char, short, int, and long. And this is the size in bits. So char has a minimum size of 8 bits, and on our lab machines, it's 8 bits. Short has a minimum size of 16 bits, and it's 16 bits on our lab machines. Int has a minimum size of 16 bits, and it's 32 bits in our lab machines. And long has a minimum size of 32 bits, and it's 64 bits in our lab machines. And these unsigned, can't be negative integers are represented with exactly that formula I showed you earlier. So you can get all the possible values based on, if I set a set of bits, what value do I get with that formula? Shows you all the values. And all of these are allowed to be bigger, though you'll struggle to find a system where char is not 8 bits. Okay, so you might say, if these sizes vary, what if I actually care how big my numbers are, and I'm not happy with the minimums? How can I find that out? So there is a way in the C++ standard library to query those sizes. So there's two main ways, or three main ways. So one thing is there's this header climits. It's called climits because it's based on a C header called limits.h. And it has constants defined, ulong underscore max, uint underscore max, ushort underscore max, uchar underscore max, which are the maximums for the unsigned types. There's similar things which are long max for signed long, and so the normal long, and so on. And you can look up in the reference manual what all these constants are named, because I wouldn't expect you to get that they didn't write out short as a whole word. I would have to look that up. So for example, on our lab machines, ushort underscore max is 65535, which is equal to 2 to the 16 minus 1. So another option is there's a header called limits, which defines a template class called standard numeric limits, numeric underscore limits, which is a template. You specify the type you want, and it has a static member function called max. And it also has a static member function called min, if you want that. And this works for any integer type. If you just want to know the length in bytes, there's a built-in operator called sizeof. I know this looks like a function call, but it's actually an operator, and it has to be because, well, you can't just pass unsigned long, which is the name of a type, not a variable, to a function. And so, for example, on our lab machines, if you ask what's the size of unsigned long, it's going to return 8 because it's 8 bytes long. So 64 bits is 8 bytes. Any questions on any of these? Okay. So one thing we need to talk about is numbering parts of numbers. So, for example, sometimes I might want to talk about the first bit in a number. And I could mean two different things. I could mean that the first bit is the least significant bit is the bit which has the least effect on the value of the number. If we wrote the number in English, it would be the number, the bit we write all the way on the right. I could also say that the first bit is the most significant bit. It would be the bit we write all the way on the left in English. And none of these are wrong. Because first bit is not actually precise enough. So there's two viable ways for me to number the bits, and you need to know, if I say first bit, which one I'm actually talking about. And both of them kind of make sense. Like, you know, there's reasons I might want to use either numbering. So one question you might say is, well, this is nice for like examples. Does it matter when I'm actually programming? And the answer when you're programming is mostly no. Because in C, you don't have a way to say, give me bit 3 of this number. There are ways of saying, give me the third least significant bit or something like that. But there's not a way of saying, just give me bit 3. There's no way to do that. So we have another issue, which is numbering bytes. So if I have a 4-byte number, I can represent it with, you know, with the bytes in either direction. And you can think of an n-byte number as the same thing as a base 256 number. And just like base 16, we have this conversion to binary. Base 256 has this conversion to binary where we just write out the bits of each byte, each of the 256-bit 0 to 255 bit digits, which is a byte. It's an 8-bit digit. And again, we can number the bytes in either way. We can either have the byte which has the least effect on the value be numbered 0 or be numbered 3 for a 4-byte number. And again, there's nothing, none of these is more natural. Like, it might make sense to say we want the first byte to be the one that we sort of apply first when we're using this formula, that we, you know, multiply times 256 to the 0. We want to call that byte 0. Or we might say we want the first byte to be the one I'd write first in English, or so. And again, you can ask the question, well, does it actually matter? Like, is this useful for anything but if I'm writing out bytes on a test? And the answer, unfortunately, is yes. In our machines, we can ask for a particular byte of a number with a number. Because they're stored in memory, every byte in memory has its own address, a number associated with it. And we can ask for particular bytes of a number. And so our machines and our compilers and our operating systems need to choose what numbering are they going to use when we have a 4-byte integer. Because we can ask, give me the third byte of that integer. And the machine is going to give us something, and it needs to decide consistently what that is. And there are two options here. And it turns out that in the real world, both of them are used. So that's wonderful. So here, for example, I have memory. I have a whole bunch of 64-bit values. And let's say I have this value. And if I expand this in terms of bytes, it's 1 times 256 to the 2 plus 228 times 256 to the 1, plus 95 times 256 to the 0. I can convert this to bits by converting 1 to 8 bits of binary, 228 to 8 bits of binary, 95 to 8 bits of binary, putting them all together, adding leading zeros, and that's the number in binary. In memory, this is going to be stored as a series of bytes, because each part of memory, each byte has its own address, and the next byte has the address that's one more than that. And there are two options for storing this. We can either say, well, this number is at address 0. That means byte 0 of memory could either contain 0, the most significant part of the number, the part that we're not seeing, which is being, you know, 0 times 256 to the 7. It could be that 0, or it could have the 95, the part that's times 256 to the 0. Both of these are valid options, and you can find machines which do both of these, either of these options. And in either case, we have to store the different bytes of the number at each of the addresses. So if we have what is called big endian, where the most significant byte has the lowest address, then we store 5 zeros, the 1, that's in the 256 to the second place, the 228, that's in the 256 to the first place, and the 95, that's in the ones place. If we have little endian, we store the 95 that's in the ones place, then the 228 that's in the 256 place, then the 1 that's in the 256 to the second place, then the 0 in the 256 to the third place, and so on. So in this class, all the machines we're going to care about have chosen little endian. They've all chosen the option where the byte with the lowest address stores the least significant part. And the reason we're doing that is because all the machines you probably have access to these days work that way. So x86 is always little endian. ARM can do either, but is usually little endian, and ARM is the most popular processor for like cell phones. And that takes care of most of the machines you're likely to be programming in the near future. But there are machines, especially historically, which use big endian. Notably, a lot of the internet protocols use big endian because at the time the protocols were being made, big endian was the dominant choice among machines that existed. So any questions about what's happening here? So, because endianness is about that you can request particular parts of a number as individual bytes, you can actually absorb it in C. So here's some code where I store a value, this value here, this big hexadecimal number. And because it's hexadecimal, we have 4 bits per hexadecimal digit. This means that each byte of the number is 2 hexadecimal digits. So the least significant byte is EF, the second least significant byte is CD, and so on. So we can easily divide this number up into the bytes it will be represented as by just taking pairs of hexadecimal digits. If you want them as a binary, you just convert those hexadecimal digits to binary one digit at a time. And so here what I'm doing is I'm printing out the value in hexadecimal. This is the hex operator to cout, is how I convert cout to print out all numbers in hexadecimal. And then I get a pointer to the value, but I cast this pointer to a pointer to unsigned chars. And the reason I'm doing that is unsigned char is 1 byte. So this is giving me not a pointer to an 8-byte number, but a pointer to a 1-byte number. So I'm looking at my 8-byte number as a series of 1-byte numbers. So it's the same memory address. So I have the memory address of the start of this 8-byte number, but I just am looking at the single byte that's there rather than 8 bytes starting there. So I take, and I treat it as an array. So I'm using this array subsort syntax. So I'm pretending I have an eight element array of 1 byte numbers at that address. And so that's exactly going to access each of the bytes of the number. So in this loop, I iterate from 0 to 7, inclusive, and I output pointer of 0, pointer of 1, pointer of 2. So I'm outputting the byte that's first, the byte at the lowest address, the byte at the second lowest address, and so on. And I output a space afterwards. I have a cast here to int, because if I didn't do that, unsigned char is a character type, and it's going to try to print it out based on how ASCII works. And it's going to like try to print out a letter for me, and I don't want that. I want a number. And remember, I set hexadecimal earlier, so everything is being printed out in hexadecimal. All the integers are in hexadecimal. So if I run this on a lab machine, I get output like this. So first, I print out the whole number, and it gets printed out in the normal order. Why in the normal order? Because we're printing things out for people to read in English. We expect them to have the most significant part leftmost and the least significant part rightmost. Like all the integers we're printing out, we print out in that English order, because you'd be very confused if we decided that because the machine did something internally differently, we didn't print things out like English expected. And then I print out each of the bytes. So I first print out EF, the least significant byte, then CD, then AB, and so on. And note that each of the bytes I'm still printing out as a normal hexadecimal number without like reversing the digits, because still printing them out like we expect in English as a whole number. So this is on a lab machine where the least significant byte, the part that when we write it in English order is rightmost, is at the lowest address. So it's the first thing printed out from the for loop. If I were to run this on a big endian system, I'd get the most significant byte, the part which is leftmost at the lowest address. So that would be printed out first in the for loop. So any questions about what this code does? What the difference is showing, and so on. Okay. So little endian, general rule is least significant part has the lowest address, big endian, the most significant part has the lowest address. That's how I remember it. You can also remember like little endian index 0 is the ones place, big endian index n minus 1 is the ones place. Okay. And as I said, little endian is dominant, and that's why we're using it in this course. So there's a bunch of types of processors you probably haven't heard of: Spark, Power, Alpha, MIPS, which all typically use big endian. And a lot of architectures actually can do either endianness. Like they have a switch that's typically set by the OS at boot time to decide what endianness they're using. And ARM is an example of this. So ARM often has switchable endianness, can be either little or big endian, and typically the operating system decides at boot time what to use. Yes, and sometimes there are things which aren't little or big endian. So this is usually what might be politely called a historical mistake, but these are things that really exist. So for example, on little endian ARM systems, doubles are stored in a way which is kind of a mix between little and big endian for historical reasons, mostly because ARM floating point was designed based on big endian ARM, but to work on 32-bit systems, and floats are 64 bits, so they made this weird compromise to make that consistent with little endian ARM. Yes, but for the most part, you won't come across this. So I just note some common misconceptions about endianness. So first of all, endianness is about numbering. So usually on a page, I'll put things such that the lower number is first in the order you'd read things in English. usually. But, you know, if I number things explicitly the other way, that doesn't mean I change the endianness. Like, these two pictures of memory are the same. It doesn't matter that I happen to have some things lower on the page. Also, endianness is not going to be about bit order in this class, and the reason why is bits don't have addresses. We don't have a way of getting the address of a particular bit. We can only get the address of a byte. So we're never going to talk about endianness of with bits. It's always going to be about bytes, because the machine doesn't have a way of saying, give me byte 17 of this number. But we did see with that C++ code, we have a way of saying, give me byte 2 of this number. We can actually do that in C++. Also, when we write out bytes, like the output of that program, when I write out a number, I'm going to write it out in English such that the leftmost part of the number is the most significant part. So if I'm writing out the bytes of a number, each of the bytes I'm going to write out that way. I'm not going to decide because it's big endian that I'm or little endian that I'm going to write the bytes in the wrong order for how we read numbers in English. So I'll still probably write the bytes out so byte 0 is the leftmost on the page, but within each byte I'm not going to flip the bits unless I explicitly say so. Like, you can assume I'm writing it out like I'd write out a base 10 number in English when I'm writing out a series of numbers. Okay. So that's on endianness. So our next topic is going to be about negative numbers. And I'm going to give a brief preview. We're going to talk about three different schemes for implementing negative numbers. And all of them are going to have the property that if we take our unsigned numbers, that we're going to take the first about half of the unsigned numbers, and we're going to give the same values in the way we're representing negative numbers. So all our negative numbers are going to be stolen from these upper half of possible values for the unsigned numbers. So we're basically going to cut the number of positive numbers we can represent in half and use the top half with the same bit pattern to represent negative numbers instead. And this has the nice property that I can convert between unsigned and signed numbers that are positive if both of them can be represented without doing anything. Like, the conversion is I just use the same bits as long as it's still in the range of possible numbers. So we're going to talk about three schemes which all have this nice property. So there are other ways of representing signed numbers which don't. We're just not going to consider them. And there's one of these schemes that we actually end up using in machines. So we have these bigger numbers, and again, So we're going to have to choose how we order the negative numbers in this last half of the possible bits, which generally is going to be the bits where the top bit is set to 1. Those are what we're going to use to represent our negative numbers. But we have multiple valuable choices for how we decide to order the negative numbers in this space. And all of them have advantages and disadvantages. And so here's the summary of the ones we'll talk about. We'll do this next time. So we have sign and magnitude, which is going to be basically that the top bit is a minus sign. We have something called 1's complement and something called 2's complement. And these are both things where we reverse the order conceptually of the magnitudes in the last half. And we'll see why that's a good idea next time. So that's what I have for today. Good luck on lab and such.